change in that, novel takes place in a snowstorm. And I thought I'd read that to you. Just, I mean, has anybody read The Greater Trumps? Well, it's about the tarot cards, and I didn't know much about them. I read quite a bit about them when I read Williams's book on witchcraft, which is a really, you know, it's a scholarly and very solid piece of work on all the medieval magicians and types of witchcraft that were used. And I'm sure that this is one reason he draws on these for his novels, because he has enough actual facts to draw from, so that he doesn't just fabricate these things out of his imagination, but he actually has them as part of his knowledge. But I thought this is kind of beside the point, because it isn't really connected with anything except the snowstorm. And I thought the snowstorm was quite connected with us, especially since I fell very deeply into a snowdrift on the way down here. And I thought, well, I guess I'll read this little bit about the snowstorm and let you know what should happen in case all the world were going to be covered with snow. Gareth, the trouble with Williams is that you really would like to keep on going back and back and back, and then finally you get to the beginning of the book, and you know you don't have time to read through a whole novel, so I'll just have to start anywhere. But, and also, fortunately, the name of the heroine is Nancy.
Oh!
So I thought that was nice, too. And might as well have some things that fit. The plot is it's not necessary for you to know the whole thing, but the main thing for you to know about is that one of the old men, oh, and how apropos, we have a black cat besides to help the witchcraft. One of the men, actually a grandfather of the young man who supposedly was engaged to Nancy, has set about to kill one of the members of her family, and mainly because, as a gypsy, he is very eager to get control of these tarot cards that Nancy's father has received as an inheritance from a friend of his. They happen to be the originals of all the tarot cards. In other words, like Heidegger, they are the cards behind the cards. Now that's really something, you know, when you can get to the point where you get the originals back of the originals. It's like in The Place of the Lion, those of you who have started it, know that, notice I didn't say those of you who finished it, I said those of you who have started to read it, maybe you have finished some of you, that there again you get the models or the beings behind the actual representations as we know them. And these are the cards that are behind all the other cards that were used for fortune telling in former days. And because we never find anything new on the earth, we have to go back to the Middle Ages and pick up something. So we picked up those cards, and you know, that's what we started in with again, along with astrology and that whole business. It's really interesting how we do have to go back even for the demonic. We can't find anything new. Sybil helped her brother in, and then she gave Ralph a quick hand with the door. It closed gradually and was made fast. Her back against it, Sybil turned gently, removing the kitten from her numb arm, and saw Lothair sinking onto a seat, Stephen leaning against the opposite wall, and Joanna, all dripping with melting snow, facing a snarling Aaron. "I've come," she cried. "I've come. Don't hide him, Aaron. I've come to see him wake." Then this is in the midst of the storm, out in the country where the man lives who wants to kill Henry, and also the man who has started this tremendous snowstorm. Now I don't think we're going to blame the snowstorm on him that we're having, but I thought that it You know, when you saw that heavy snow coming today, and it just, and if you've been up here in many winters as we have, and you know that this can go on and on and on, you can well wonder if someone, you know, where is the someone that is actually turning on all these feathers and really pushing them, because they never seem to stop. It's fun for us now because we haven't had much, but there are times when, you know, you can really get tired of seeing it coming and coming and coming. But the snowstorm that is involved in this story is a blizzard, and it's like it's as if you had this kind of snow and the kind of winds we had last week, when it was really, you know, it blew up here and there and down and up, and you just felt as if everything was at cross purposes, and there was an energy let loose that was almost frightening. It's frightening because at Holden you don't usually get that kind of wind. You do in Minnesota and on the prairies. I don't know about the prairies of Washington, but certainly on the Dakotas and Minnesota and Iowa, Illinois, you get these tremendous winds that blow in the winter and the summer too. But that is what we know as blizzards, and we just really don't have them up here. They're really quiet snowstorms like this one, and it doesn't really feel like a storm. It just kind of comes down and comes down and comes down. But the kind of blizzard that is involved in this story is a real blizzard. It's a snow heavy like this one, but also involved in a great deal of wind and a frightening kind of energy that seems to be a part of it. They were just having a visit, and then all of a sudden Ralph was interrupted and only given time hastily to explain how the storm had caught and held the car, how he had at last got out and gone a little way to see if there was another road or anything, how he had lost his way back, and then encountered the other two wanderers with whom he had gone along, partly because they had seemed to be aiming somewhere, partly to give Joanna an arm. "And I must say," he added quietly and hastily to Sybil, "the set of carols that she sung all the time curdled anything in me that the snow didn't. Oh, she was a lively little Robin Redbreast." Sybil thought, as she herself was carried off, quite unnecessarily, she assured them, that there was something not wholly inapplicable in the phrase. The two women were apparently the least exhausted of all the five. Joanna was sitting on one of the hall chairs, her old red cloak pulled round her and snow melting and pouring from her on every side. Aaron obviously wasn't a bit pleased, but nothing could be done. He couldn't push Joanna and Stephen out into the blizzard, and no one naturally would help him, and they wouldn't go. "But I wonder," Sybil thought, "why they dislike each other so. Is it just family, or is it something special?" Mm-hmm. That's rather good. Is it just family that causes you to dislike other people so much? That's the effect of the snowstorm on them. They're completely covered. Nobody thinks that anybody is going to survive, and even Aaron, who doesn't like any of these people who are coming to visit him, realizes that, you know, something has to be done. They were guests. They were coming out for Christmas, and so they have to be taken care of. I can't find the part that I wanted. The one where the real heavy snow comes isn't where I'm at, but I'm going to read you this part because it refers back to it. Nancy has taken the brunt of the snowstorm upon her. She's gone out into the storm, allowed the storm to just come and go through her. And as it goes through her, it is in a remarkable way, because she's willing to let herself even be killed by it. In a remarkable way, the energy that is demonic in the snowstorm is turned back to its original course, and it's put back to where it belongs in the under the lordship of God, and not in the command of this Aaron, the gypsy, who wants to use it for necromancy, for magical power over somebody else. The way of exchange there with Nancy and her willingness to just let it happen to her is a frightening and terrible thing. I'm just going to read this one part so that she so that you get an idea of what it is that has happened. The reason that she did this is because she realized, she saw the originals of the tarot cards, which were little people that were standing in a room in a private little place that Aaron had them hidden, and she realized that these were in a remarkable way symbols of some powers that he was going to use in order to wreak vengeance on her father and try to get the cards that her father didn't want to give away. In the process, she, as I say, she had to allow herself to be ready to be killed. Her aunt Sybil is the one who is the most of the person who is the gospel person throughout the whole story from the beginning. Nancy becomes that, but Sybil is that in the beginning, and Sybil, it's through Sybil's comments that I'm going to read about Nancy. Sybil herself, being prepared for anything at any moment, at those who have surrendered themselves must naturally be, all amazement being concentrated in a single, adoring amazement at the mere fact of love, and leaving no startled surprise for the changes and new beauties that attend it. Sybil herself listened gravely and intelligently to the tale. She saw, not in her own mind so much as in Nancy's, the whole earth under the stress of what had been heard and seen, taking on a strange aspect. She saw, but this more in her own mind, the remote figure of the juggler standing in the void before creation was, and flinging up the glowing balls which came into being as they left his hands and became planets and stars, and they remained, some of them poised in the air, but others fell almost at once and dropped down below and soared again, until the creating form was lost behind the flight and the maze of the worlds. She saw, as the girl's excited voice rushed on, the four great figures between whom the earth itself hovered, the double manifestation of a single fact, the body and soul of human existence, the emperor and empress, these are figures in the tarot cards, and diagonally opposite them, the hierophants, male and female, the quadruple security of knowledge and process upon earth. The rushing chariot of the world came from among them, and it again parted, and on one side went the hermit, the soul in its delighted solitude of contemplation, and on the other, the lovers, the soul in its delighted society of terrestrial love. And earth came out of them, Nancy said breathlessly, earth and air and fire and water, the lesser elements pouring down from below the greater trumps. But these also in the dance, and in each of those four cataracts, she saw the figure of the fool leaping and dancing in joy. So I thought it was the hangman, and I screamed. Nancy had dashed to another part of the tale, and Sybil remembered the crucifixions of her past, and by each of them where she herself hung and screamed and writhed, she saw the golden halo, and the hands of the fool holding and easing her, and heard his voice murmuring peace. And what shall we do? What shall we do? The young creature babbled at last, and half risen, clutched hard at Sybil and broke into a storm of tears. But as she wept and agonized, Sybil's hands held and eased her, and Sybil's voice murmured peace. And then as this goes on, you discover in the process of the story that Nancy is able to stop this terrible Holocaust from happening. And what eventually occurs is this wonderful ending to this little. To this chapter, or to this the story, is that all the people who saw the snowstorm in all the little villages and towns of England just thought how pleasant it was that they were having a snowy Christmas, never realizing what they were being saved from, of course, that they were being saved from not a watery grave, but a snowy one. When I first read The Greater Trumps, I thought, oh, I just think I can ever understand that, because I didn't know what those cards looked like, and I just couldn't catch the connections. But then I read the book on witchcraft, and then I read it again, and realized that there's a great deal in this book that is not solved. It's not clear. And so I would not recommend your reading that as a first try, because it's not, there are a lot of things in it that are not that easy to really catch as far as the meaning is concerned. But it's an exciting book, and like all of Williams, they all deal in the same kind of battle, and yet every one of them is so different in its setting and structure that you feel as if you're in a whole nother setup again, and then you have to get used to it again, and you have to think about it again. You have to read back, as I said last time, over again as to what exactly is he saying. we were going to talk about, and we are sometime either this week or the end of this week, the beginning of next week, we are going to talk about The Descent into Hell, that novel, and The Place of the Lion, for those of you who want to discuss a particular novel that you've read. How many of you have gotten anywhere in the novels, or have you only been able to buy them? I heard about Kurt. Yes. You had to stay up all night and finish it.
Didn't you?
How did you like it?
I enjoyed it very much.
You, which one was it you read?
Descent into Hell. Mm-hmm. I think even though once I got done, I could go to bed.
Yeah.
If sleep is your interest, you may lose out.
Well, it's true that's right.
It bothers.
Yeah. And I don't think Williams ever lets you alone after you start reading him, even if you don't read any other books of his. That's an interesting thing. Anybody else? Marianne?
Yeah, I read Descent into Hell.
You did.
Afterwards, I was so frightened. I was just scared, and I went on a walk, and
did you think you were going to get over it by going for a walk?
No, it was just the dumb thing to do.
I put my head under a pillow.
Came around me and snow was blowing down, and I'm just so scared, and I ran back. So that was my experience.
And that was that. Lise?
Well, I was just thinking, but I already answered it, how hard it was. I remember when I read Shadows of Ecstasy, and I had to get down to read it that way, because I couldn't stand not having anybody else talk to about it. And just not being able to go to sleep, but you have to go to sleep sometimes. But it was just
I think that's one reason why it's very good to read somebody like Charles Williams at Holden, for two reasons. One we're going to discuss specifically in connection with the image of the city, but also because you really have to get up here. You have to get out of the idea that there's just, well, we're, you know, this is a little hamlet, and it's this is where peace is. Well, you know, anybody who lives here very intensely knows that isn't where it is, really, but because there is no peace in terms of a place. It's it is in terms of the people that are there. And so but you do need the feeling and the sensitivity and perception of this kind of depth that Charles Williams gives you. And it isn't because he's using witchcraft as sort of one of his methods of developing it, but it's because of the fact that the truths that he is getting across to us are such that we don't want to get them. We really don't want to absorb them. And the only way they become palatable is if they get really, you know, exciting and ticklish and frightening, you know, then we're willing to take them.
I think something you mentioned before talking about the exercise, not exorcise, but exercise, but in ways that we are not willing, we just kind of have the way our lives go, we don't pick these things up. And in order to talk about sort of the way simple exercise in mind, to think towards something that otherwise you can't be, you don't have no idea it's there, you miss the point completely.
No, the and this is what I want to talk about first. It's not first anymore, but sort of toward the beginning of this discussion is Williams's use of symbols and why he uses this and what it has to do with us as far as our reading and as far as our thinking. Now, you may think, well, it's just not my cup of tea to be, I'm not interested in that kind of writing. Well, I think that you may not be interested in it, but I think it behooves you, like a lot of things. It's a good thing to try something on for size and actually give it a fair trial. Really exercise yourself in it, extend your muscles a little bit so that they actually become used to using some angles of your intellect that are not commonly used by you. It's a very important thing to grasp first and foremost in understanding Charles Williams, the use of the term image. Now, anybody at Holden thinks of Image Lake, and you know, you think of image as being some kind of a reflection, an exact reflection in the water or in a mirror of somebody who is looking or something that is being reflected in a still piece of either glass or water. This is not the same kind of thing that is being used, let me say, in a literary connotation in terms of imagery, as far as particularly in terms of Charles Williams and how he understands it. Really, it's a funny thing, but people very often discuss poetry, they discuss writing in general, they just discuss novels and books and so on, as if, you know, it doesn't make any difference, you know, you don't have to know anything about it. It's, you know, you've got to tell this, it hits you, hurts your guts, you know, really get me, do as I grab me. Well, I mean, you know, as if it didn't make any difference whether you used your head as far as knowing anything about how that thing has been put together. It would be just as if I were to say to Rich Kemmerer, well, you know, I don't need to know anything about art. I know what I like. You know, I have that on my walls, and or I like to look at it in the art museums, and you don't need to, you can't really tell me anything about it that I need to know. Well, the only difference between these two fields in artistic expression is that because we all use language, we think we are masters of it, and therefore we know how to deal with it. We don't all use paintbrushes. We don't all carve, and we don't all aren't all able to make stained glass or do welding or all kinds of things that artists do. And therefore, there is sometimes a little bit of deference over against someone who is in that field of art over against someone who uses language. People who use language, well, they're the same as we are. Well, of course, if you want to do poetry or if you want to write a crazy novel like Charles Williams does, you know, that's, well, that, you know, that may be his English cup of tea, but, you know, it doesn't really appeal to me, and so I won't bother with it. Well, you know, you cut off your nose to spite your face when you talk that way, and you might as well just, you know, I mean, why you'd bother to come to a lifestyle year, I don't know, because the whole point in learning is to expose yourselves to some of these things that you are not adept at, that you don't know all the ins and outs of, and that in learning about them, you're going to become far more aware of the in-depth meaning that is there when you once let go and become a part of it. Now, this is extremely true in poetry, but it is also true of writing such as Williams did in his novels, which he did not think, as I said last time, were his first class writings. He considered his poetry the most important thing that he did. And yet it's his novels that really get to people and really have turned people on, not only to his writing, but have really made a lot of people understand Christianity in a whole different depth. And so that's why I say that it's important for us to understand what imagery is. What is an image, and how is it used in, for instance, in these novels in particular? Now, I think one reason we get so kind of sloppy and opinionated in the way we deal with writing is because we live in a rather semi-political society, and everybody, we all are, exposed to the media, and we know what Cronkite says, or what's his name, the other man on the other one. Well, there are three of them, but who? Yeah, and then that guy that the NBC fellow. He's dead, isn't he?
No.
Oh, Huntley died. Well, Brinkley's still alive. Well, he's not on anymore, though, I don't think. But anyway, we always feel that, well, we've gotten sort of the inside thing on all these different political issues. And then we read Time and Newsweek. My goodness, what better information can you get? You really got it. So, we can all become, we're all authorities on whatever happens. And we can tell, from our bench warming positions what the best position on the field would be in the name of foreign policy or what have you. Well, this kind of easygoing style of approach to a lot of learning, to a lot of things that require learning, is I think carries over very definitely in the field of language and the language arts in particular, because they're things that we're connected with. I don't say, however, that the that the people that seem to be making the decisions are always that learned either. I mean, I don't know that Harvard professors, all of them, know exactly what should be done with the world, so I can't say that I always know that, it's in Kissinger's hands, and I'm sure he's right. But I do think that, and I think sometimes the judgment of the man in the street over against what's going on in the world may be a lot more sound than that which is going on at the conference tables, which never seem to be concluded with anything at all, but more of the same. But it still holds that this kind of easygoing, sloppy thinking that I call sloppy thinking has a tendency to be infectious and contagious, and we apply it all over the place so that we are always making statements about things that we really know very little about. And that's why your rhetoric, for instance, is an important thing to have. You're supposed to be learning something about how to distinguish between truth and falsehood, something between propaganda and illusion and so on. And all these things make a difference in the way in which you think and also the way in which you articulate. Now for the in writing something like a novel, most people would think, well, I don't really think I need an image for a novel, because I'm going to use people as, there are people in my novel, and there are plots, and that's alive, and, I don't need, imagery is for poetry. For Williams, this was not the case, because for him, an image was an extremely important thing in order to uncover a truth. His novels are not written, they're written for entertainment, as I said, in terms of enjoyment, excitement, involvement, as far as your reading them is concerned. But they also, in the way in which they're written, do uncover a tremendous truth in terms of the Christian life, in terms of the life of the planet as a whole and the people that live on it, and our relationship to the being, as he sometimes calls him, who is in control of the universe. Imagery and the image is not something that you pick up and figure out, well, now I've got this image, now I'm going to work it out this way, I'm going to fix it so that it will prove this and this and this in my book. This is the way I'm going to work it out. That's not the way Williams would use an image. If Williams discovered an image that he felt was going to have life to it, as far as his reading or writing a book was concerned, or a story, or whatever, it would have to have a life of its own. It has to be something that has meaning in and of itself. And he isn't going to switch it around so that it's not going to disagree with his own particular convictions. In other words, an image is something that actually it's sort of like found art. I mean, it's there. It has a whole life of its own. It has a being of its own. And in your discovering of it, you find that there is a truth there that you didn't know existed, that you didn't realize that there was a relationship there with something else. And it's your intellectual imagination that puts those two things together. That puts the image, that is the and you understand, of course, that, you know, when you think of imagination, you've got image right in it. This whole concept of something that gives you a living reality that you're dealing with. This whole concept of something that gives you a living reality that you're dealing with, and yet it's not something that is just like all of us sitting right here. It's something that's removed from us. And therefore, when we start looking at it, we project ourselves towards it, and we relate back to something else. And this is this kind of an interrelationship, this kind of transference back and forth, is the work of the trained and the intellectual imagination. And as I said last time, Williams didn't finish college, but he applied himself to what he did. He really paid attention to the things that he was doing. So as he was a proofreader and became a book reviewer, he really learned more than the average person who probably has a PhD in English literature. And that's why he became a master from Oxford as an honorary degree, which is an unusual thing to have happen when the man has not finished college. But it's because of the fact that the intellectual imagination is trained and has paid attention to these differences, to these relationships, that the image begins to take the kind of form and development development that you find in Williams's novels. Now, a lot of times, how many of you know what an allegory is? Now, I suppose you don't dare tell me because you say, oh, and she's going to make fun of me because I'll say something and she'll say, oh, well, that's how dumb you are. I won't, because believe me, there are a lot of different ways of understanding allegories and a lot of different ways of defining them. Do you know anything that is an allegory? Can you think of any kind of a book that's really quite famous? Pilgrim's Progress, yeah. Absolutely perfect example of an allegory. You couldn't have a better one. What is there about Pilgrim's Progress that makes it an allegory? Now I asked you what an allegory was. I said, does anybody know what an example of an allegory? And then, you know, you came up with Pilgrim's Progress. Why did you say Pilgrim's Progress? We could all close our eyes and then somebody could say something. Don't be afraid. Isn't that difficult if you make a mistake? And you know, really, I really don't think you can make a mistake. Because, you know, there are a lot of different reasons why you would pick it out. Why do you think, why would you pick out Pilgrim's Progress as an allegory? Because you remember that it was called that in high school, maybe, or college.
The way symbols are used in Pilgrim's Progress.
The way symbols are used. The story of Pilgrim's Progress is what? Story of what? Remember? Supposed to be the sort of the...
It's a pilgrim as he progresses to, and he goes through all these trials.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be what? Similar to what? In
ours.
Our life as Christians. Isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's the life of, and in fact, you know, so, you know, Bunyan isn't going to have any mistakes made. He even called him Christian. Be sure that you didn't fall into any pits of doubt or unbelief because this man's name is Christian. Now, do you identify with him? Okay, this is what you go through. And then, you know, he meets all these terrible things. He goes through doubt and despair and all these different things. Liz? Oh, you were just putting a pencil in. Okay, I just thought if you wanted to say something, I didn't want to stop you. But an allegory is simply something is a sort of a dramatic way of pulling out a story or an image that explains something else. And instead of having to, you don't have to go and keep on saying, he is doing this like that, which is what we know as a simile. He is like that, or a Christian life is like a trip through a very bad territory with lots of frightening things. Now that'd be a very dull way to put it, wouldn't it? But what does Bunyan do? Well, he had to go to prison in order to think it up, but you know, I think sometimes that's what you have to do. You almost have to go to prison or have to go into some kind of solitary to do any thinking because you get so busy with all the frippery of our present existence that we don't get much actual thinking done. But that's where he wrote it, and he came out with a real dramatic representation of what happens to this man as he went through all these very mythological kinds of experiences, and yet they applied to the Christian life. I remember when I was in graduate school and studying it in my 18th century prose course, and my professor was really a rationalist. Oh, he was really strong and very, very clear on what, you know, the meanings of everything, and always had footnotes, and we had to explain why things were this way and what's being referred to. He could not figure out why I understood Pilgrim's Progress without any, you know, without any difficulty, and I would just answer without
And he said, "My, my, Miss Asgard, you must have done a great deal of reading on this." And you know, I was such a peanut in terms of being any, having any boldness of the spirit. I should have said, "Well, I am a Christian." I didn't say that. I just smiled and pretended that I'd done a lot of reading. But I realized when I was going through this that all those writers were writing about Christian truths and Christian experiences, and nobody else in the class, or maybe there might have been a few others who were equally tongue-tied, who didn't want to admit it, that they belonged to the same troop, but they didn't understand, they didn't know that this was a real thing, that Christianity is actual, that these experiences were true, that Christians do go through sloughs of despond, that we do go into despair, that we do meet temptations, that we do wander and get lost. I mean, you know, that this was actually what had been happening to me. I knew what it was like. I'd recently become a Christian, and I knew how awful it was to try to find my way back sometimes from where I'd been. And this kind of thing was a lost thing to the professor and to most of the class. And the other day when I was reading Williams, I thought, I wonder how long it will be that there will still be available to, I mean, that people will still be around who actually understand all of the Christian connotations of Milton and Shakespeare and Bunyan and Donne and even Charles Williams, you know? Because, you know, gradually you get more and more secularized, farther away from Scripture, farther away from the biblical truths, farther away from Christian experience. And pretty soon, all of that will be just like the Greek mythology. You're going to have all footnotes explaining, you know, well, now this refers to conviction of sin. This refers to a custom they had of having a kind of a supper every week in their gatherings. This is a strange rite that was had something to do with water. They had an idea that water had magic in it in connection with their particular religion. See what I mean? I mean, those things are going to be so far from removed from the average person that if he does, you know, research, it's going to have to be research. Now, it depends on you whether or not that really takes place, or whether the communication is still open and, you know, people really find out about it and continue to be enclaves of Christians who will not allow it to become simply a matter of footnotes and documentaries, and will actually be a live thing and a live option. And certainly Williams does not intend that it should become a matter of research. He intends that it should be a live thing for everybody, and that the novels that he wrote were written in that vein, so that there would be no doubt that Christianity is not something that is just to be put on the shelf and to be written up in you know, sort of theses and books and so on, but that it is something that is lived and in which you are willing to be suffering and involved in. I think one of the things about an image too that you have to remember in terms of its relationship to Christianity is that how do you really understand Christianity? How do you understand Christianity? Do you understand it because you can make an outline and check off a proof text on it so that, well, I believe this, and because I believe this, I can believe this, and I know that this is true because I've checked this out, and, I mean, sort of the way you would a theorem or a or can you work out a sort of an atomic model to explain what Christianity is? Can you do that? How do you understand Christianity? How do we get it? How do we grow in it? Is it in terms of outlines? Is it in terms of a sort of some kind of a construction affair that we see, or what is it?
Quite the opposite, I think.
What is it?
I don't think it's something we do understand.
All right.
More like we don't understand.
Well, that's right. It is. It's something you don't understand. Yeah. Yeah. You don't understand it, but how then do you, if you don't understand it, how do you communicate it?
Your image, like Christ did, the images of light of the world, salt of the earth.
All right, exactly. That, you see, the very fact that you don't understand it, you can't really say, I got it. It's perfectly clear to me. And you just sit down and I'll explain it. You can't, because it's, as you say, it's not that way. But it is, but if you look at what Jesus used, and what would you say Jesus used? What would you call them?
Images.
They're images. Aren't they? You know, I'm the shepherd. I'm the light. I'm the way. I mean, does it mean he really is a shepherd? I mean, is he running around taking care of lambs? He wasn't David. That wasn't his name. His name is Jesus. And he was a, what was he? He wasn't a shepherd. What was he? Actually, by trade. A carpenter. So he should have said, I am a saw. Or I suppose, I don't know if they had saws, but whatever they did. No, or I am a hammer. Well, you know, you've heard that song. I got a hammer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, I mean, that would have been what you would have thought. Well, that's where it's at, you know. You say what you are, and somehow that's the way it is. But that is not what an image does. An image does not mean that I am what I said. It simply says, this is what I am in terms of your, what can happen to you if you're a part of me. I'll be a shepherd to you. I'm going to be a light to you. I'm going to be a way to you. Now that puts a whole different light. You see how that does to an image? That means you become a part of the image, as well as the image having a life of its own. Now the relationship between you and the image, in other words, say the relationship between Jesus as a good shepherd and you as the needy sheep, that requires imagination. Now, anybody in this room that says he or she doesn't have an imagination, forget it, because you all have been using it and using it and using it for years and years. And you've got lots of imaginative muscles that you've been using. And to you know, kind of hide behind it and say, well, I don't have any imagination. I just do ordinary things. I mean, that's not true. Because Jesus has been developing an imagination in every one of his believers from the very beginning. And that's why it's quite natural that actually that Christians ought to write imaginative books, because of the fact that the Lord himself began using stories right away in order to get his points across. Because the parables certainly do that too. Elise?
How much that's
the way
God represents himself to his people.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Or things that God isn't.
Exactly.
Or things that he is, and things we are because he isn't that, we are that, or we are that because he is.
Right.
And that, that idea that, you know, that we participate in imaging, that's where we actually learn it.
Mm-hmm.
Is we, that we talk about making it connections all the time, that we're thinking about how, in talking about images, it's like a graphic kind of description of making the connection
mm-hmm.
to the other thing, from me to the world,
mm-hmm.
to whatever's true, how it's...
To the base of the image, yeah.
But that is part in particular, the lifestyle years, as opposed to the normal education, which comes up with, too often, a list of books read, a list of apps, a list of degrees, that participating image.
Exactly.
I think one thing that strikes me too, at least with that, is when you were talking about the exchange before, Mary, I was thinking, okay, you exchange, does that mean you own something? And in all of the images, it's when you own it, it is a list of books or facts, but if you participate in it, then you only share, and you don't get that kind of a stop. You don't stop with that. Yeah, I mean, just I was trying to think of owning and as versus participating in that.
Well, I think that this whole understanding of the image and your exchange with an image, your understanding of how you relate to an image, is basic also to what we talked about last time with Charles Williams's understanding his use of the word co-inherence, which I said last time was a difficult one for many people to understand and to grab hold of, and yet it isn't really. I think it's sometimes it's part of our old Adam or old Eve that doesn't want it, because we know that if we accept it, it's going to cause us trouble, because it's basic to what he calls the way of exchange. Now, if you have an image of a shepherd, what is one of the images of the shepherd that Jesus uses that is not he doesn't have a whole, it's not the parable, it's a straight, just the image. What's one of them? What does the good shepherd do?
Leads the flock to find the one.
All right, he leads the flock. He does something else. What does he do?
He lays down his life
for the sheep, okay? He lays down his life for the sheep. All right, now, when he lays down his life for the sheep, that means that the sheep, in order to be safe, to be fed, to be cared for, they are going to have to be, it's going to have to be done through the means of the Good Shepherd, right? He's the image, as far as we're concerned, of what's going to happen. Now, there is the beginning of the exchange that Charles Williams talks about when he says that all of life is a co-inherence. Now you say, well, how does a co-inherence come along with exchange? Well, look here. If the good shepherd is going to keep his sheep alive, and it's important for him that his sheep stay alive, isn't it? Because he's got to take his sheep back to, if he owns them, all right, he's got to keep them alive. If he's doing it for somebody else, then it's his business to return them, all of them back. Okay, then in order for that to happen, he has got to do something for them to protect them. So he's going to lie down and he's going to give his life for the sheep so that no wolf can enter in through that door in which through which the sheep go in and out through the sheepfold. All right. Now, the sheep are dependent on the shepherd, right? They have to have the shepherd take care of them. But on the other hand, the shepherd needs the sheep. He needs the sheep. He wants the sheep because because they're important to him. In any kind of a straight story about sheep and shepherd, it isn't because he just dotes on every one of those little lambs, but because they've got value, monetary value. Okay? Now, you might say, well, that's a kind of a crass way to talk about Jesus as a good shepherd. I mean, that he just wants us because of our value to him. Aren't you any value to him? I mean, is there only a value because it's monetary? I mean, you know very well that we are valuable to him because he loves us. Therefore, he's willing to lie down and, you know, and that's what he did, didn't he? Okay, now then, that is the beginning of the way of exchange as far as the Christian life is concerned, when you realize that the good shepherd lays his life down for his sheep, and you're one of the sheep. A life has been laid down for you so that you can still live. So then what can you do thereafter? I mean, then your life, what can it be? Are you supposed to just, you know, relax and find yourself a good fat meadow to sit in, or what? I mean, you know, it's obviously a lesson. It's not really, you know, it's not very subtle. But obviously, then, the life that the sheep that has been redeemed in that way would be to go out and also be that kind of a person for the next one that comes along. The interesting thing about images is that they do not hold water. They are not consistent. Anybody who tries to make a parable fit all the way through is going to run into trouble. And one of the great things about images is that they, because they have a life of their own, they have to be independent. And they can't fit philosophically and mathematically every little bit of truth that you happen to want them to have. And therefore, you might say, well, okay, but you know, okay, I'm a sheep, and then I get saved by the shepherd. How can a sheep go and save another sheep? I can't lie down, the wolf would eat me up. I mean, you see the inconsistency? I mean, that's stupid. But that's the kind of thing, an image is not supposed to explain something in terms of a line by line outline, or as I say, a chemical formula or a mathematical or algebraic equation. It's to give you a picture, a feeling, an experience of something that is a reality. And then you go on from there and live out from that. And that's why when Steve said he couldn't, you can't understand it. You can't put it down in an equation form. But what you have to use is an image. So that you can, that the image, okay, it bursts. I mean, any of the parables, if you start making them, you know, well, but what about this? And what do we do with that? Now, they've really worked hard to bring the elder brother into line, you know, and the prodigal son. He's really been important. Actually, the story of the prodigal son was basically a story about whom? About the father. About the fact that the father had his arms open for both. But boy, you know, I tell you, we've had sermons on the elder brother, and we've had sermons on how far you can go as a prodigal. And, you know, what was involved, and that was always interesting. But, you know, the thing is, this is what an image has to have. An image has to have an independent life, and it has to be allowed to live its life. And you can't squeeze it and make it fit, you know, every little thing. Because if you do that, you're doing, not blasphemy, but sort of despite to something that has a kind of a fragility to it, and that can only be a hint to you as to what the reality is, and then you go on from there. And that's where your imagination comes in, because you work on it from everything that you bring, and Karn works on it from what she brings, and everybody else, you know, you all have your own interpretations, you have your own relationships to it. And that's why Williams believed so strongly in using imagery and using images, because they did have that tremendous ability to inspire the imagination, so that you have to take part in reading one of his books. You don't just sit and let it happen to you or look at a TV program the way you can, you know, you can look at something like that and not get involved. You can't read Charles Williams like that. He's just too exhausting. I mean, you'd stop right in the middle of the first, about the first 10 pages, because it's just too much work to go into to try to get at that. And that's why I spent as much time as I did on the images, because I think sometimes you get scared out when somebody talks about imagery and images, and you forget that you've been dealing in them all your life, ever since you were in Sunday school. And there's nothing frightening about them at all. But you do have to remember that your imagination does need some training and does need some exercising if it's going to grow in terms of its expression of those images and the relationship of those images to the bases from which they come. And that's why I'm so enthusiastic about Charles Williams, I guess, because I feel that what he has to say in terms of the way in which he says it is important enough for you to spend time on it and to try to dig out the meanings for yourself. There's one thing that is extremely important in terms of this understanding of images in relationship with the Christian life, and I have to close with this because I want you to understand it from Charles Williams's point of view. The church historically, in terms of its history of sanctity, has always emphasized what we call the negative way. That is, it's been the ascetic approach. The more you pair off of your life, the better if you're going to get closer to God. The farther you get from the fleshy things of this world, the better person you're going to be. Charles Williams, his approach is not the negative way of images, but the affirmation of the way of images. In other words, that actually it's when you really can say yes to life that you are coming closer to the meaning of the incarnation and the creation, the whole fullness of God in humanity. But he's very careful in his usage of this way of affirmation of images, and the fact that it's an affirmative way of life, that in fact the theology that he is known by is a theology of romantic love. Now, don't get completely confused, although it is what it says it is, but it does have a lot to do with relationships of men and women, of families, of life together in terms of its fullness and richness, and that as an image again of the relationship that we have with God. That love is also a reflection and an image of our relationship to God in Christ. And this affirmation of this kind of thing, instead of affirming celibacy as this is the way, which the Roman Catholic Church had always done, his approach, and many other people too, affirmed the fact that God came to earth incarnate to make manhood and mankind and womankind a part of him, not to deny it, not to make us less, but to make us more. The only thing that Charles Williams says that you have to remember is that you have to have that they complement each other. That although you may not believe that it's right to be celibate, you also, and you may not think that it's right to always say no to everything, you still have to remember that you can't say yes to everything either, and that they do kind of balance each other, that they do check each other out. And one of the great things that he says that I think is worth remembering, and is something that you can mull over in your head and ask yourself, what does it mean? He says, this also is thou. Neither is this thou. In other words, you don't have a handle on God or the way that he has for you to live or for anyone to live. But it isn't that simple. And it's for each one of you to understand for yourselves, what does that mean? Because it's a kind of statement that is what I consider seminal, because it is a seed. It does make you think about ways of living and ways of seeing and ways of worshiping, ways of imaging. This is thou, also is thou. Neither is this thou.